Welcome to the Trailblazers and Troublemakers podcast. I'm your host, Scott Costin. On today's episode, you'll hear my interview with Anthony Fenton, a researcher, academic, and one of the leading authorities on Canada's relationship with Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf states. I spoke with Anthony just minutes before the United States released the latest details from its investigation into the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. So, Anthony, there's a lot to discuss about the Canada-Saudi Arabia relationship, which, of course, has soured quite a bit in the last few years. But before we get into that, can you tell listeners a bit about yourself, your studies, and the type of research you do on the Gulf states?
I've been working on a PhD dissertation for, the better part of the last 8 years. I've been in dissertation mode, having finished my coursework at York University in 2014-ish. There were a couple of papers I had to hand in that straggled in over the next year or so. But since about 2013, I've been focusing exclusively on Canada's relations with the states that comprise the Gulf Cooperation Council, chiefly among them Saudi Arabia, of course, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Qatar, Kuwait, and Oman. And essentially, the topic, the scope of my research, which has been, in terms of history, beginning in the more or less the earliest moment I could find as a point of contact, but, significant point of contact between Canada and the Arabian Gulf, going back around the World War II era, even though there's some significant moments, for example, with the discovery of oil in Bahrain, there's the creation of the British American Petroleum Company, BAPCO, in Bahrain, and they had to have a Canadian, a nominal Canadian board membership for that, for whatever reason. And it's one of the ones you find in the history books, the early references. But so basically, I've been trying to look at the political economy of Canada's ties with the Gulf from basically World War II to the present. So it's an interesting study in that I've been able to get some good access to archival records going back that far. But the archival records, given the state of Canadian release, classified state records, it cuts off in the mid 90s. And so it's like I have good archival research that strengthens my dissertation. But it cuts off. And then at that point in the mid 90s, from the mid 90s to current, I kind of just do more like open source research. The problem has been that there's not a lot of prior academic work that's been done on this relationship, surprisingly, despite the history, despite the depth of the relations, etc. So it's interesting. It's been quite a process, and it's coming to an end pretty soon. It's been, as I said, almost 8 years. And of course, so much has happened along the way. So it's a process of like researching the archives on the one hand and researching every day-to-day development as it unfolds. So that's in a nutshell what I've been up to. And hopefully the light is at the end of the tunnel soon in that respect, if not for the arms deal, the big arms deal itself, which is still, all systems go, no matter what obstacles seem to be thrown in this path.
Yeah, and we'll certainly get to that arms deal shortly. I wanted to talk to you first about a couple of recent news reports. The first one I read in the Toronto Star about a gentleman named Ahmed Alarbi. I'm not sure if I'm saying that correctly, but Alarbi is a 24-year-old Saudi national who sought asylum in Canada in 2019 after being openly critical of the Saudi regime. And then recently, according to the reports, he was summoned to the Saudi embassy in Ottawa, went there for some kind of a meeting or what they may have described as an interrogation. And he's apparently traveled back to Saudi Arabia and has a new Twitter account that shows him praising the country's rulers. I'm wondering, is this something you've looked into at all? And if so, what do you make of it?
Yeah, I probably don't know much more than you or anyone else does in this trip, but I've been following it, sure. Unfortunately, what we saw initially emerge was, I think it was Omar Abdulaziz, who's probably the well-known Saudi dissident living in Canada. He was the focus of the dissident documentary, which has come out recently about the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi. He was working closely with Jamal Khashoggi when he was assassinated, like literally the day before Khashoggi disappeared. in October of 2018, the Citizen Lab in Toronto had released a report showing how Omar Abdulaziz, I think that that's a report that, that showed his phone had been similarly hacked, as was Khashoggi's with this this Israeli company's software, NSO, it's the NSO group, Pegasus software. Lots of, there's lots of really good stuff. People can research on that. There's actually an interesting piece on Al Jazeera about how the same software is used to infiltrate Al Jazeera journalists' phones as well. In any case, this gentleman who you're referring to that came up in the news this past week was, I believe, an associate, you know, working with Omar Abdulaziz and working on his program, his project to try and basically destabilize the Saudi royal family from outside the kingdom, because there's a growing number of dissidents who've made their way outside of Saudi Arabia, sought asylum, increasing number seemingly, and have found asylum in Canada. And there are others, there are other higher level and more well-known, we can probably get to after, like Al Jabri being one of them.
But he's my next question.
In the case of Al-Harbi, it sounds suspicious. And I believe that the likes of Omar Abdulaziz are kind of raising the alarm there, that like one day he's here, one day he's speaking out strongly against the regime, the next day he's supposedly back in Saudi Arabia. Who knows really? I mean, who knows what he's, well, he's got a literal or figurative gun to his head. You know, we know from films, and I encourage people to watch them, like the Dissident, the capabilities that the Saudi state has to keep their citizens under surveillance in ways that, you know, people like Edward Snowden revealed that they do so in via the vehicles like the National Security Agency in the US and globally, you know, just vacuuming up information on them, monitoring text messages, monitoring chats, and so obviously social media posts, and they have an army of their own like social media warriors, basically a troll farm inside Saudi Arabia who tries to control discourse specifically within the kingdom, but also tries to affect it on social media globally, because more so than even Canada and the US, I think Twitter in particular is a key app for Saudi citizens. So they really try to keep a handle on that to the extent they can. And then you have the countervailing forces like those led by Omar Abdulaziz and his dissident crew outside of the country. But so a lot remains to be seen. I'm sure more details on this particular case will emerge. Canadian officials are tight-lipped so far on that, and all the other, you know, Game of Thrones type machinations that are going on in and around Canada with respect to Saudi Arabia. So we'll just kind of like a wait and see issue that we're staying on top of.
Okay. So getting on to Saad Al-Jabri, who you mentioned. So this is someone who is the former right-hand man to the former crown prince. And I saw a few weeks ago that there's a new lawsuit by companies friendly with the current crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman. And it's accusing Al-Jabri of embezzling billions of dollars from Saudi businesses. Now, Al-Jabri's been in Canada for a few years, and I'm wondering what you can tell listeners about Al-Jabri, what brought him to Canada, and you know, what your understanding of this situation is in terms of this new lawsuit.
Yeah, this is the one of most significance, I would say, and I think it has a lot. I can't say for sure, but it probably has a lot to do or a lot of bearing on the ongoing diplomatic spat between Canada and Saudi Arabia that's been underway since August of 2018 now. The longest spat that such sort of rift between the two countries that I know of in the history of the relationship. But Al-Jabri is significant because as you know, before, up until the previous king, Abdullah died in January of 2015, and that's when the Salman and the father and son duo basically took over. Initially, everything seemed relatively normal. So the former crown prince that you mentioned, Mohammed bin Nayef, him and his father were a long time at the head of the Saudi Ministry of Interior, which oversees their border guard, their frontier police, their special emergency forces. And it was a very powerful position within the Saudi royal family, the kingdom overall. And Al-Jabri was basically his right-hand man. And what most people in Canada probably don't know is that Mohammed bin Nayef and Al-Jabri were kind of friends of Canada. They were kind of like the two of the people within the Saudi royal family circles that were closest to high-level Canadian officials, Canadian intelligence, Canadian companies that are, you know, selling products, defense products, weapons, and so forth to the Saudi Ministry of Interior. And so they're partners. They're seen as friends and partners. And when they then subsequently were turfed out, basically a process that began 2016, but really came to a head in 2017 with the ultimate removal of Mohammed bin Nayef from his position in the succession line, removal from is no longer Crown Prince, and the new Crown Prince is Mohammed bin Salman. And basically, Mohammed bin Nayef is elbowed to the side. Ultimately, he ended up being arrested. He was basically under house arrest, as far as anyone knew, for over a year. And then I think it was early 2020, late 2019, he was basically arrested. Al-Jabri, in the meantime, saw the writing on the wall and had gotten, wisely, I guess, gotten out of the kingdom. He wasn't able to get all of his family out, unfortunately, and they've kind of used, I think, the two remaining kids of his who are there as bargaining chips or tools of, or tried to leverage, apply leverage against him to get him either to come back or, who knows, give them assurances that he's not going to reveal secrets, essentially. So,
because they were incarcerated, weren't they, Anthony?
His daughter and son, you'll nobody knows exactly. They believe that they're being held incommunicado. We don't know if it's under a house arrest. I don't know, or if it's an actual like imprisonment, you know, some sort of secret prison. Yeah, it could be. I don't know. They may, for all intents and purposes, they may as well be. But other of his kids live in Canada. One of them is a doctor, medical doctor, who's basically become his spokesperson. I'm not sure if Al-Jabri himself has spoken publicly. It's mostly been done through his son. But yeah, so you have these explosive allegations just in this last week. There's a new detail about the Khashoggi assassination that emerged in the documents that were filed in Canada, Canadian courts, which showed that the airplanes that shuttled the assassins to Turkey to carry out the assassination were, the company had been seized by the Saudi Public Investment Fund, which itself is basically controlled by the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. So yeah, so it's kind of indicating yet another sort of direct linkage to the Crown Prince when they've tried to, despite all the evidence that's emerged from the Turkish government in particular, and that shows the complicity of the Mr. Bonesaw in the murder. So this is all playing out. One of the things we should mention is that the Ontario court, based on the documents you mentioned that were the filing by the Saudi companies, froze Jabri's assets. So that was an irritant, no doubt. And we're seeing things kind of snowballing. And it's going to be interesting to see how that all plays out and how or what bearing that's going to have ultimately on the Canada-Saudi relationship. Like, nobody's clear on what the role the Canadian government is playing. For example, are they providing a security detail to Jabri? Because there have been accusations that the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman sent a similarly styled death squad to Canada to try and take out Al-Jabri a week or so after the Khashoggi assassination. And they said there's also been more recent efforts to do so as well. Wow. Not to mention there have also been credible reports of attempts to silence Omar Abdulaziz, who lives in Montreal. So it's an interesting times where you see this rogue Crown Prince trying to send literal assassination teams, allegedly, around the world to take out his enemies. And now with this new Biden presidency, you see all these other changes happening, like the Biden administration saying, you know, they're going to limit arms sales to Saudi Arabia. They're going to release the report on the Khashoggi assassination that we believe shows why they believe the Crown Prince was complicit or directly involved in the assassination of Khashoggi. basically they're saying they're you always have to be careful with what they say and then what they subsequently do ultimately. Right. Given the fact that there's, you know, they're in United States is increasing their military footprint inside of Saudi Arabia. The long-standing relationship they've had with them as far as basically providing a security umbrella for the royal family for decades now. The military bases in, you know, the Fifth Fleet in Bahrain, the massive military base in nearby in Qatar, bases in the UAE and Kuwait, you know, just strewn throughout the region. So for them to then say, well, we're going to do a reassessment and a reset of our relationship with Saudi Arabia, got to take that with a grain of salt and just see what that means on the ground. But all at the same time, Saudi Arabia, as themselves seeing the writing on the wall, have made gestures of, you know, reconciliation. They released the one Canadian, former Canadian UBC student, Lujane Al-Haflou, who was spent 1,000 days for having the temerity to drive a car, to advocate for women being allowed to drive in Saudi Arabia, which the Crown Prince actually has since instituted. While she was in prison, women have been subsequently allowed to drive, but she offered the threat of a good example, right? And so she had to be put in prison. Now she was released nominally, but she's still not allowed out of the country. She hasn't been exonerated, and she's accused the Saudi state of torturing her and sexual assault while she was imprisoned, and which they've denied. So that's still playing out. But in the meantime, from a public relations perspective, it got them some you know, goodwill in the press. And that's another thing to mention at the same time is, you know, the people are still, for a brief period when Khashoggi was assassinated in 2018, you know, people were, oh, we gotta distance ourselves from this brutal Saudi regime, et cetera. But as time has gone on, you know, the capital is flowing, you know, into Saudi Arabia. The PGA golf tour is going there to swing their clubs, and you know, the show must go on. And so they're,
Tim Hortons is even going there, right?
Yeah, Tim Hortons has been there, but they were in the headlines not too long ago as one. There's this drive to try and get more foreign companies to base their headquarters regionally, and they were cited as an example of, oh, this Canada, Tim Hortons has moved in, and there was Tim Hortons again this past week on display at the local arms bazaar. The Middle East's largest weapons exposition took place in Abu Dhabi the other day, this past week, and yeah, there's Tim Hortons. You know, you see a couple of Canadian military attachés to the region holding a box of Timbits and smiling with a thumbs up online there. But yeah, so that's all to say, these palace wars, so to speak, are unfolding before our eyes. The Biden administration has brought the new sort of dynamic into the mix. It's also to point out that the Qatar blockade was going on from mid-summer of 2017 with a sort of wink and a nod from the Trump administration. They put a stop to that. That was probably the first major step they took to placate the Biden administration incoming, to say, okay, look, we're gonna ease off this blockade of Qatar. Remember, they were calling for the shutdown of Al Jazeera. They were calling it all sorts of absurd demands before they would resume ties with their close partner there in the GCC. Whereas the one remaining sticking point, as far as like what all the kind of strange things that Saudi Arabia did, like out of the norm for a Saudi royal family, is this diplomatic feud with Canada. So it's like, what's it going to take for that to get resolved? I suspect that this question of Al Jabri and Mohammed bin Naif, that's got to be resolved. That's got to be bound up with how the Canadian situation has got to be resolved. But I will also note, just this week, because I've been saying all along since 2018, one of the major things that Saudi Arabia did against Canada in conjunction with breaking diplomatic ties was stop buying Canadian wheat. And, you know, just for the first time since the diplomatic spat, that earlier this week, they announced that they're going to be buying their first batch of wheat from Canada since then in the coming days.
That's an interesting development for sure. And you know, we spoke about 6 months ago for an article I was writing, and you kind of talked about how, despite the the problems in the relationship between the two countries. Saudi oil was still coming to Canada and Canadian arms were still going to Saudi Arabia. What's the current state right now of the LAV deal and other armaments flowing from Canada into Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, as far as we know, all systems are go. You know, just about a week and a half ago, a Saudi ship showed up in Baltimore, Dundalk Marine Terminal, to pick up at least a dozen LAVs that were seen on the dock, because that day, for the second time in a couple of weeks, and those are the first, but significantly, those are the first two demonstrations at that port in Baltimore, because it's being used as a transshipment point for these Canadian-made LAVs. But the funny thing is, the reason the General Dynamics is using Baltimore as the port to export the LAVs through is because of the lone protest that was carried out in New Brunswick in 2018, at the end mm-hmm. of 2018. It was after that they said, okay, we're going to avoid a repeat of that protest there, where it involved the workers actually, in just for a brief period, refused to cross the protest line. It's sort of an act of solidarity. They've been sued via the Canadian Industrial Relations Board, in a suit that's still carrying out in that forum. And by they, I'm referring, I believe it's the DP World, which is the port operator, which is owned by the United Arab Emirates ruling family, ultimately. So here you have the UAE ruling family running the port that was exporting the Canadian labs to the Saudi, you know, via the Saudi cargo ships. You have a single protest. They decide to totally reroute their, you know, their supply chain, have put the labs back on these what they call the Paddock trucking company run out of Hamilton, Ontario. So they put them on flatbed trucks, drive them down to Baltimore, and then drop them off the port there. And I mentioned Paddock because there was a protest there a month ago today, I believe January 25th or 6th, that got quite a few headlines, even internationally. So they staged basically a sit-in on the premises of Paddock, because they are the trucking company for years that General Dynamics has used, either to deliver them to Halifax port previously before the port switched from Halifax to New Brunswick briefly. And then, so they've been proceeding at pace. We're looking at $5.5 billion worth that have been shipped to Saudi Arabia since 2017. There've been a few months here and there when there've been disruptions, like around the time of the spat and the Khashoggi assassination. There's a 2-3 month period, but they announced almost immediately after when the spat happened, okay, don't worry, we're not going to stop sending you oil. You're not going to stop sending us the labs. But significantly, Canada did, when Khashoggi was assassinated, they did, like I said a few minutes ago, they did the posturing. Oh, we got to reevaluate our relationship with Saudi Arabia in light of this assassination. So Canada put a pause on the issuance of new export permits to Saudi Arabia. But they didn't pause the existing ones, including the labs. But they did it while they did a review of the overall arms deals with them. And then ultimately they lifted it. And when they lifted it, they issued a memo that said, yeah, we got 40, we've processed over 40 export permits for different companies that want to ship weapons to Saudi Arabia. And so we don't really see any reason to no longer maintain this moratorium. And around about this time last year, so March, April, they lifted it after what they said. It was so funny how it played out, because they announced it with this kind of clumsy press conference or media. I remember, because I was on the media teleconference with Champagne, the former foreign affairs minister, where he said, okay, oh yeah, well, I want to tell you that we've successfully renegotiated and renegotiated a new and more transparent contract for the labs to Saudi Arabia, part of which included like Saudi Arabia agreeing to pay for the labs, because they were at that point around $3 billion in arrears on the labs that had already been delivered. They're just like accepting delivery of these labs and not paying for them. It's really good arrangement. And who knows what kind of terms they had, but the Canadian government fronted General Dynamics $650 million to cover costs for those labs. in the meantime. And then Saudi Arabia's issued a couple of $500 payments, but there's still a couple billion dollars in arrears, but the labs continue to flow. But the funny thing was, he said, oh, we have this new, more transparent contract, but he gave no details, ergo like zero transparency. So yeah, it's proceeded at pace, despite everything, despite, you know, the obvious like problematic nature of the deal.
And it should be noted, I mean, there, the lav is, I mean, technically it's called a light armored vehicle, but it's not light. It can transport troops. It can also have very significant weaponry mounted on it. And the fear being that it's either being used in Saudi Arabia to suppress human rights and or possibly in the Saudi Arabia, you know, being using it to wage war in Yemen. You've shown by retweeting and sharing things on your Twitter account that there are at least some what appear to be credible concerns that Canadian equipment's been used in that war. I'm looking back in October when Canada was pressured to suspend sale of target acquisition technology to Turkey because it could be used in the conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan. And Turkey turned around and said to Canada, well, this is a double standard because you keep shipping your arms and equipment to Saudi Arabia. Do you think Turkey had a point there that this is a double standard?
Well, I do. I do believe that. But I think it's funny because Canada would probably privately. Yeah, but the Saudi war in Yemen is a legitimate one. You know, that would be their argument because that's basically been their argument from day one. You look back to the 2016 memos that the law professor Daniel Terp was able to get released through the courts. In those memos in 2016, April 2016, that Stéphane Dion signed off on, the assessments by the you know, the bureaucrats inside Foreign Affairs Canada said, well, these labs could be useful to countering stability in Yemen, right? But at the same time, anytime the Canadian government's been confronted with the fact that like older model labs, specifically, of course, remember, we have a 30-year relationship of providing these same light armor or different iterations of these same light armor vehicles to the Saudis beginning in the early 1980s process. They have been seen in the conflict. So whether they've been like on Yemeni soil or not, they're clearly engaging with Yemeni rebels in the context of the civil war. There's without question. I mean, the Yemeni rebels have destroyed dozens of Canadian-made labs over the course of this 6 years that the war has been unfolding. There's like literally no question of that. But what the Canadian government says, they're saying, we see no credible evidence of Canadian labs being deployed inside Yemen. We've seen no credible evidence of Canadian labs being used to commit human rights violations, like as though it would be even possible or plausible to like have a footage of the lab literally like killing a civilian. Like when was the last time that happened? But they didn't need that in the case of Turkey, right? I mean, they just there's an excellent report that Project Plowshares put together. Got a lot of attention in that moment and ultimately forced the government's hand to stop exporting this. Was essentially one company, L3 Westcam, based in Burlington, Ontario, has been making cameras that are mounted on whether it's attack helicopters, surveillance aircraft, etc. They have maritime versions. They even competed to be mounted on the labs themselves to put this Westcam kit. These sensors, but it's very sensitive equipment, very key critical equipment to target acquisition and so forth in the context of firing, you know, drone strikes, etc.
Beyond the geopolitical considerations that you just mentioned, the difference could be just a dollars and cents thing. The lab deal is a massive, massive multi-billion dollar deal with, you know, involving the City of London, Ontario, people there who work at General Dynamics Land Systems. Could the difference be in the government's approach that the contract that the company had, you know, with Turkey was much smaller in terms of, you know, money and jobs and all of that than the one that's been done with Saudi Arabia for the labs?
Yeah, well, practically speaking, sure. I mean, we've heard a lot about the penalties that would be incurred with the lab contract. But, you know, there'd be a couple billion dollars in
penalty. Oh, if we pulled out?
Okay. Yeah. Whereas there's no such arrangement with the Turkish government. First of all, it's not what distinguishes the lab deal is that it's literally a government-to-government contract by virtue of the Canadian Commercial Corporation is the literal go-between between the Saudi government and General Dynamics Canada. The Canadian Commercial Corporation is a crown corporation, right? Whereas the deal between the Westcam and Turkey is like, okay, so the Turkish drone manufacturer may very well be owned by a son-in-law of Erdogan or what have you, but it's not technically like a government-to-government deal. So they can more easily do that. But at the same time, these same Westcam sensors are also being supplied to Saudi Arabia, and they're also being supplied to the UAE and Egypt, who are all using these sensors in their prosecution of the war on Yemen. You know, in 2017, Westcam opened a service center inside Riyadh, likely because of the increased tempo of the use of those sensors in the conflict in Yemen. You know, and it's like, but they also have a service center in Turkey too, which is probably like, well, it's probably still active because they sent them a lot, like right up to this conflict. Turkey was a major recipient, as far as the Statistics Canada data can tell us, of these Westcam sensors. So,
one thing we know is that Saudi nationals who criticize the regime are persecuted in many, many different ways. I'm wondering, Anthony, if you, as a Canadian citizen who's been a frequent chronicler of things in Saudi Arabia and, you know, the critic as well. Have you ever, you know, been target of any kind of harassment or intimidation or surveillance or anything like that that you're aware of?
It's hard to say. I would almost say at this point, probably. It's funny you mention that because just this is just anecdotal, but even in the last couple of weeks, I've noticed a couple of someone from the Saudi embassy in Ottawa following me on Twitter. I was like, oh, that's interesting. But then another guy from the Saudi embassy in Ottawa unfollowed me. So like, oh, what do I do? and I've also noticed I've been blocked on like some of the key sort of Saudi military affiliated accounts on Instagram. One of them, I just discovered that they blocked me, and I was like
preemptively blocked before you even try to engage with them.
And I hadn't engaged with them at all. In fact, I just kind of like, it would be like observe only, and they would have to have been able to cross-reference. Like I have basically a burner, I don't mind saying openly, a burner account for Instagram where I follow these social media accounts. That's where I've gotten captured a lot of the videos and footage over the years of the labs and the PGWs, the Winnipeg, you know, made sniper rifles that have been in the Yemen conflict quite a bit. But other than that, no, there's been no real evidence. I mean, I've seen some late last year, a big uptick in like phishing attempts on my, through one of my email accounts. But I've never seen anything suspicious on my phone, but that could be because, you know, there's nowadays, you know, if anyone looks into those documentaries, investigative pieces that have looked into Pegasus and NSO group and their ability to like have zero click surveillance of your phone. Now where in the past, like they might've needed you to click on a link that they sent, like a malware type link that would then in turn infect your phone. What they discovered through the case of Omar Abdulaziz in Montreal and other Saudi dissidents and Emirati dissidents and whatnot, is that they don't need that anymore, that they can literally just find ways to hack your phone and read your texts and do whatever they want with that information. So I could be like, I've never, like Omar Abdulaziz got lucky in that Citizen Lab basically identified and was able to verify that they had hacked his phone. But people like me, you know, we don't have those tools at our disposal. So, you know, so it could be that we're currently under surveillance right now and wouldn't know it, right? So you just operate as though you may be and try to you know, share information privately or as encrypted as possible when, you know, depending on the level of degree of sensitivity the information might have, and just proceed accordingly. That's all you can do, but time will tell, I guess.
Yeah. So if people wanted to follow what's going on in the Gulf more closely, what media would you recommend, whether it be, you know, mainstream or independent media? Are there any that you want to recommend that people could follow just to keep track of what's going on there?
Certainly, like it's a mixed bag. I personally try to follow everything, and you know, you kind of, because of my experience, I'm able to filter, you know, the fact from fiction, or, you know, rumor from fact. But you know, I do, despite some of the problems I have with Al Jazeera, for example, you know, they're obviously they're owned by the Qatari government, but they also do really good work. A lot of good investigative pieces. There's a lot of good, you know, people I follow on Twitter, you know, a lot of good Twitter accounts. Middle East Eye does good reporting, but again, you got to be wary of their financial backing and whatnot. But unfortunately, you know, the Canadian media is pretty poor when it comes to general coverage of what's going on in the region.
I wanted to ask you about that, because I find it very interesting. You know, I think you are probably the foremost expert. If you're not the foremost expert, you're one of the top few on these topics in Canada. And although you have appeared from time to time in mainstream, quote unquote, media or corporate media, whatever you want to call it, you seem to be called upon very sparingly. I find it curious. Do you ever wonder why you don't get more media queries from you know, big outlets?
Yeah, I mean, I don't wonder, because I'm pretty sure it's pretty clear to me why that's the case. Like the Globe and Mail, for example, has intimated, you know, their reporters, like, oh, once you finish your PhD, you know, you'll. It's like, I'm 47 years old, man. I mean, I was a journalist for almost a decade before going back and doing the PhD, you know, and my master's and PhD. It's like, it's almost like just a fake excuse, because ultimately what everything would boil down to is the fact that I'm an openly Marxist, you know, leftist researcher. You know, I'm affiliated with the Marxist department at York University, and I think ultimately that's it. The ideas, the critique that I represent is a little bit, it's too radical. Even though, like, I go to probably greater lengths than others to get the facts straight and to bolster my analysis to ground it in the kind of research that nobody else is doing. And then you look at who are the people who are frequently called upon to provide the comments and and maybe it's also the case that I'm not very good at the one line, you know, pithy, you know, succinct quote that they're looking for. But like the Tom Junos and the Besma Momanis, they're the ones who are called upon. And they, again, what are they? You know, you got establishment intellectuals, academics with tenure at mainstream academic departments, who are named to task forces by the federal government. Who get federal funding from the Department of National Defense to conduct studies into Canada's ties with the Middle East. These are the types of establishment figures who are called upon, whatever the topic in Canadian, you know, Canadian foreign affairs or domestic politics. For the most part, corporate media leans on these establishment elite academia, right, who are really part of the ruling. You know, in my other research, I'm more generally like specialized in researching the Canadian ruling class and the history of the Canadian ruling class, the history of how they've organized themselves and how they're comprised and so forth. And elite academia is a big part of how the overall composition of the Canadian ruling class. And I'm not part of it, right? Even though, like, I'll disclaim that I have ancestral linkages to the Canadian ruling class, right? Like, I have my great-great-grandfather was one of, like, the founding fathers of many aspects of elite Canadian society. But that doesn't get me a free pass, fortunately, because I don't really want to be part of that club, you know, to be honest with you. But at the same time, it is a double standard that, as you say, if someone's, if I am on a level with these other academics in terms of my knowledge base. If I know more than they do in terms of like the amount of research I've done, the experiences I have, et cetera, there's no reason to exclude me from the conversation other than these other factors, such as just the tendencies of corporate media to go to the people that they're most comfortable with, right?
So finally, Anthony, before we get out of here, I'm wondering if people want to follow you and get in touch with you, where would you like them to do that? Your Twitter account is awesome. I think it's an indispensable resource. Do you want to tell people where to find you there? And if you've got a website or a blog, you can plug that as well.
Yeah, that's pretty much it for now. I've actually been, they could visit, I'm just at Anthony Fenton on Twitter. And that's pretty much where I've been residing for a number of years, almost exclusively. I am going to start writing up papers, articles pretty soon. I'm thinking of doing a Patreon or a Substack type account, barring, you know, another venue to write.
I will be your first patron if you give me that opportunity. And I also really hope that your research is going to lead to a book. I mean, it seems like a no-brainer, but is that part of the plan to write a full-length book at some point?
Oh, absolutely. I'd love to be able to turn the dissertation into a book. I've got two chapter contributions, two edited collections that are in the process of being completed. One I might miss the boat on, I'm afraid, if I can't get it in really soon, with Fernwood, and then another one out of University of Windsor in 2019. There was a conference there on specifically on Canada and Saudi Arabia, and we're all supposed to contribute chapters to that. So check my Twitter feed for updates on that, or hopefully by then on my Twitter bio, I would have the link to wherever those books are, or my new Patreon account. Yeah, but thanks for inquiring, and appreciate anyone who reaches out.
It's been wonderful having you on. Thanks so much for taking the time, and hopefully we can connect again down the road.
For sure, anytime.
That wraps up this episode of the Trailblazers and Troublemakers podcast. Thanks very much for listening in. If you have any feedback for us, you can send an email to trailtroublepod@gmail.com. And please follow us on Twitter @trailtroublepod. Hope you'll join us next time. Bye for now.